why would we think God would want to preserve the people that are described in Romans chapter 1? The insolent haters of God. Because we know from the very beginning He promised a seed that would be used to transform these people.
Welcome to the teaching ministry of Grace Family Baptist Church, Conroe. GFBC's mission is to proclaim the sufficiency of Christ to all men with a view toward biblical conversion and comprehensive discipleship. Thank you for visiting gfbcconroe.com.
Let's open up our Bibles to Romans chapter 1. And as we look at the marvel of Scripture, let's look at Romans chapter 1, starting with verse 29. It says, "They were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they know God's decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them." Now, before you charge the stage, I've not gone mad. I've not become forgetful or even flipped to the wrong page of my calendar. I know we've preached through that before. It's not that I enjoy it that much and just felt like we had to go back to it. But as we look at Romans 1, I think it sets the stage perfectly for what we're going to be talking about today in Genesis 37. Because if you read through Genesis 37, as we're about to do, and you look at the story of these brothers who conspired against their very own brother. If you read the story of the maliciousness and the evil and the hatred that they had for their own flesh and blood, I think most of us can sit back and say, well, that must be a specific one-off case. Or maybe, like we read in Romans 1 the first time, we looked at it and said, well, that may be true of some. And that may be true of just a few deranged individuals, but certainly not me. I'm better than that. And yet, we know that Romans 1, 29 through 32 was a description of all mankind. After the fall, the sinful nature that we exhibit, that's the description given of man. As we look at Genesis 37 today, I think you will see specifically why I chose to start in Romans 1. Let's go there. Genesis chapter 37. Today we'll be finishing the chapter, so we're going to start at verse 12 where we left off and go through the rest. Verse 12. "Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem." Remember that. Verse 13. "And Israel said to Joseph, are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. And he said to him, here I am. So he said to him, go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word. So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him wandering in the fields, and the man asked him, what are you seeking? I am seeking my brothers, he said. Tell me, please, where they are pasturing the flock. And the man said, they have gone away, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. Verse 18, they saw him from afar, before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams. But when Reuben heard it, he rescued him out of their hands, saying, let us not take his life. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand to restore him to his father. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the robe of many colors that he wore, and they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty, there was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Then Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. They took Joseph to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes and returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is gone, and I, where shall I go?" Then they took Joseph's robe and slaughtered a goat and dipped the robe in the blood. And they sent the robe of many colors and brought it to their father and said, "This we have found. Please identify whether it is your son's robe or not." And he identified it and said, "It is my son's robe. A fierce animal has devoured him." Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces. Then Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, "No, I shall go down to Sheol to my son, mourning." Thus his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. Well, as we look at today's text and understand the evil and the hatred that his brothers exhibited, I think it's worthwhile if we go back and perhaps if we review a few of the themes that we talked about last week. Because as we reopen the book of Genesis and as we start with chapter 37 to finish the book of Genesis, it's mindful, I believe, to go back and remind ourselves of some of those key themes, some of the points that we get in the early stages of reading Genesis for the first time, or even in the points that we've gone back to and talking about what did we learn from the fall of man. And really, the first theme that I would remind us of, this was by no means the first theme in the book of Genesis, but the first theme I want to remind us of is that the result of man's rebellion, the fall into sin, the sinful nature that we now employ, that is so accurately described in Romans 1, has led us to understand that this corruption of man has caused families to be torn apart, not just here in Jacob's life, but look at the life of Jacob as a young man in the family with his brother Esau. Families that were literally torn apart as Jacob was forced to flee in the middle of the night to avoid the wrath of his brother. We look at these families that are torn apart all because of man's rebellion, the sinful nature that man has taken on. And Genesis shows multiple cases of this happening. But it also shows more than once that it is this family line specifically that is used to bring about reconciliation to God. In fact, it's important to note this here at the very beginning, because what we're talking about in the book of Genesis and the reason for these stories in the book of Genesis is that these are historical narratives. These are historical narratives that get us from Adam to the time of Christ. And not just as the sequence of time goes, but it literally takes us from the family line of Adam to the family line of Christ. It was God's plan that would bring his seed through man. And it's important that we remind ourselves of this as we go along, because despite God's divine plan, despite his all-knowing bringing his seed through the line of man, it would still be evident to us as we read through Genesis that these families through which this seed passes are incredibly sinful families. They are comprised of incredibly sinful people. And yet God can still work his providence through these people. Now, we talked about last week, Joseph is not of the messianic line. Joseph is not the seed of promise. It's going to come through Judah. And yet, what we will see in today's text is that Judah does take a point of leadership in today's text. It's not one for glory. It's not one for honor. In fact, what we see today are the seeds of sin in the life of Judah that we'll talk a lot more about next week when we learn more about Judah's life. But he is, make no doubt, the promised seed. He's the one through which God would bring His Son many hundreds, if not thousands of years later. So what we need to understand is that the theme of Genesis is that despite the sinfulness of these families, despite just the hatred and envy and bitterness that's in these families, God will use that to still bring forth His glory. Another theme that we talked about last week is the use of foreshadowing that the Lord has in His text. When we talk about the book of Genesis, we see throughout the foreshadowing that God is using in this text to share with us what He will eventually do. And when we talk about the foreshadowing in the story of Joseph specifically, it's there to help us better see the future account of Jesus Christ. It's being used so that we might better recognize God's hand in the doing of this. In fact, if you look at the very beginning of chapter 37 where we started last week, it shows the special love of a father for his son. It shows the special place of prominence that was given to his son. It also reveals the dreams of Joseph as a form of prophecy. And Joseph sharing with his brothers, look at what the Lord will do through my dreams. In fact, as we look at it that way, and not just flippantly as, oh, these are the dreams of a young man. If these were the dreams of a young man, most, if not all, would look at those dreams, especially from the father, and say, well, he's a foolish young man at this point. He will learn, and let's just encourage him to do the right thing. But no, these dreams were interpreted by his brothers and even by his father, which earned him the rebuke of his father. These dreams were interpreted as prophecy. These dreams were interpreted as the future will of God that would be played out. And thus the hatred of his brothers was drawn up by this prophecy. There was great resentment, we read about, by his brothers on these dreams. But his brothers knew the revelation that was being brought to them. And really, when we look at this prophecy and try to understand it in the context of bigger things, I think we have to look at these and see that in the life of Christ, while he was on the earth, he fulfilled prophecy and he gave prophecy. He told his disciples, those that were closest to him, this is what has to happen. And yet they did not understand. But when he said, this is what has to happen, what did it do to the others? In fact, when he specifically said that if they destroyed this temple, he would raise it again in 3 days, it brought about great hatred and resentment from the Pharisees. It brought about all sorts of envy and strife amongst the scribes. And all of these people that heard and shared in this prophecy that Christ was sharing were privy to the fact that there were those among them who hated him because of this prophecy. And this is what's so significant about this when we look at it, is that the sharing of this prophecy, the sharing of these dreams, was not anything that brought about evil to those he shared with. There was absolutely nothing harmful in the way that he shared these dreams with his brother. Nor was there anything harmful in the way Christ shared his prophecy with the Pharisees and the scribes. There was no threat to their lives or their livelihood. And yet it brought about such resentment and such hatred that we have to look at this deeper and wonder, where does that come from? How do we see such hatred in these people? I will tell you as well, one thing that this reminds us of as we read through this text, and we see the intent of his brothers today. When we talk about his brothers seeing him from afar, and yet they were not clear whether Joseph saw them yet. But when they saw him from afar, they conspired to kill him, and their intention to kill him was but for one purpose. And what was that purpose? That purpose was not for seeing him dead. That purpose was to stop the dreams from coming true. And it says that in the text. Their goal was to disrupt the dreams. And as we've talked about in the book of Genesis, when we go all the way back to the beginning and we start in Genesis 2 and 3 and we see the working of the serpent, we see that the serpent receives the promise of God in Genesis 3 that God will bring about one who will crush his head. And the serpent's goal throughout all of Genesis, throughout the entire Old Testament, is to do one thing, and that is to disrupt the promised seed that God has sent. The goal of the serpent is to somehow get in and kill the line of the promised seed. If he can in any way disrupt that, then he knows he can foil the plan of God. And yet, foolishly perhaps, the serpent thinks this is possible. In the same way that foolishly, the brothers think that they can conspire to stop the dreams from coming true. God's will is much bigger than any of that. His will is one that you cannot deny, and his brothers could not deny. But the way that this happened is truly remarkable. And as we read this story of Joseph and what happened to him, I think that you will see truly that this was the working of God in every little detail. And there's a lot to be learned from that as we go through it today. You know, the first part I think that we look at when we talk about Romans 1, and we talk about this description of man, and then we go back and we try to somehow justify, well, okay, maybe, just maybe I can see that in a few people. Maybe understanding the recent genocide that we saw in Darfur, South Africa, or in Africa in general, not South Africa. But as we see the fact that a few individuals can come to power and they can just literally wipe out thousands. You say, well, I see Romans 1 there. And you go back and you see in Nazi Germany, in the ability of these few in power to literally wipe out thousands, hundreds of thousands, and the just evil and the hatred that's within these people. Or maybe even just in a few select deranged individuals like a Charles Manson or something to that effect, where you see somebody who just is not thinking clearly or somebody who's just mentally not all there and literally takes life in the pursuit of their pleasure. And you say, yeah, I can see Romans 1 there. Friends, I'm sorry, but none of those three describe the brothers of Joseph. These are Jacob's sons. This is the promised generations that God has given. And they're exhibiting no less evil than the three that I just mentioned there. These are evil people. They're full of absolute bitterness and hatred for their brother, their own flesh and blood. We've seen this before. In fact, in Genesis, we saw this. Early on, when it talked about Cain rising up and killing his own brother. And when we read about that story, we thought, man, how incredible to see a brother rise up against his own and take the life of his brother. But there's an important corollary there we'll get to. This is different. This is nine men who conspire together. Nine brothers of different mothers who come together and conspire against their own flesh and blood. In fact, again, as I've mentioned, Joseph did nothing evil. We talked about last week that the cultural interpretation of this text is misleading. The idea last week we talked about how we see, well, Jacob showed just unmerited favoritism for this boy. No, none of it was unmerited. None of it was unmerited. What we know about the culture of that time, if you'll recall from last week, is that the firstborn enjoyed special privileges. That the firstborn was given special privileges. They were given not only the heirship to the family throne, they were also given additional material goods. They were given all sorts of attention, and they were given a role of authority over the family that no one else enjoyed. And yet the firstborn in Jacob's family, Reuben, spoiled his birthright. He gave away his birthright, in a sense, in the way he dishonored his father. And it was every bit of his father's responsibility to take that birthright from Reuben and choose on his own doing who would receive the birthright, who would receive the authority, who would receive that special place of prominence. That was every bit Jacob's responsibility. And he chose Joseph. There's no question he loved Joseph more than the others. But there was no special favoritism in that respect. That was very much worth his effort. That was very much worthwhile, and he had every right to do so. We look at Joseph's place of sharing those dreams, and we say, well, Joseph was just being a selfish little brat. He was just trying to make fun of his brothers or maybe perhaps put himself above them. And what we know for a fact is that dreams at this time and the way these were used, the interpretation of these dreams was certainly not anything like that. This was the revelation of God accepted not only by Joseph, but by his brothers as well. It was his job to share this with his brothers. Right? It's easy for us to say, you know, I had this dream. No, this was interpreted to be prophecy. This was interpreted to be the divine revelation of God. And it was his duty to share that. The response of his brothers was the sinful nature that we saw. And that's why we say Joseph did nothing to deserve the trouble that his brothers brought. In fact, when we look at specifically the revenge that was taken out on Joseph, it's easy to see how these are men. These nine brothers are men who could act in revenge. In fact, they've already done so. If we were preaching straight through Genesis front to back, we'd have just been there a couple of weeks ago. But if you go back to Genesis 34, you'll remember that Jacob had been leaving Laban, his father-in-law. He had been returning back to the land of his fathers, and he was worried because he was going to come up to his brother Esau. And so as we went through Genesis 34, what we saw specifically was that Jacob worked his way back to Canaan very slowly, and one of the places he stopped after meeting with Esau was in Shechem. It was in Shechem. And if you recall what happened in Shechem, one of the daughters of Jacob had been violated by one of the men of Shechem. Now, the man of Shechem, one of the princes of Shechem, had come out and had pursued her and had violated her, but he had asked for her hand. And so he sent his father, or his father went to Jacob and said, "Let us dwell together in unity. Let us be peaceful to each other. Give your daughter to my son, and we will give daughters to your sons, and we'll just be one big happy family." And Jacob looks at that and says, "Okay, if we're going to do this, you must become like us. You must be circumcised like us." The men of Shechem agreed to this. King of Shechem said, "You bet. Let's line up." And they lined up and they were all circumcised. And after the third or fourth day, while they're still in pain, what happened? The brothers of Dinah, the men of Jacob's household, rose up and slaughtered every one of them. Killed every one of them out of revenge. To revenge their sister, they rose up and killed every one of them. If you read Genesis 37 and you go, "Well, boy, these guys are pretty tough guys. They're pretty mean. They've had this." And as we talked about last week, these are men who were raised with this kind of attitude. They were raised with this sort of mentality. They witnessed it in the life of Jacob early on, for heaven's sake. So we know that this was something that they were well aware of. They exhibited it in Shechem. And then they're going to use it again in Genesis 37. But against their very own brother. Joseph, in obedience to his father, rose up to go find his brothers. There's no doubt when it says that the brothers were headed to Shechem to pasture their flocks that maybe Jacob would have been a little worried. He knew what happened in Shechem. In fact, as they left Shechem in Genesis 34, Jacob said specifically, "What have you done to me? You've brought ill will on my family by what you've done, and now we have to leave," and he left because of what they did. So when the brothers rose up to take the pastures back to Shechem, there's no doubt Jacob was worried about that. There's revenge amongst the local tribes in that area against his family. And so out of concern for his sons, he calls his younger son Joseph, who's in authority, and says, "Go find them and bring back word to me. See if it is well with them," we read in verse 14. Joseph was acting in perfect obedience. In the spirit of foreshadowing again, we see that the hatred of the priests and the scribes and those in authority in Israel had for Christ when he had done nothing wrong to deserve it is just like what we read about here with Joseph. This is again, a moment that we're supposed to see to give us a bearing of the life of Christ. And when we see this and we understand that the revenge taken out by his brothers is comparable to the revenge taken out on Christ, it again brings great light to mind of what we see. So I think the question is this. Such evil hatred that was exhibited here by the brothers has to be explained by something. And that, I think, is what the second half of Genesis 37 is really about for us. Is if we can somehow get into this Genesis 37 account and understand what leads this to happen, what gets his brothers to this point that they can rise up and threatened to kill a brother, and then I think it would be helpful for us. There's no doubt there's hatred, and I use that word often, but it's because it's actually in the text. If you look at Genesis 37, where we started, go back verse 4, it says, "But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him." Verse 5, "Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him. Go down to verse 8. His brother said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us, or are you indeed to rule over us?" So they hated him. There is no doubt what their feelings were for their brother. They hated him without a question. Their hatred had everything to do with the fact that Joseph had been chosen over them. They knew what the dreams meant. They knew the revelation that God had brought. And as a result of this, it says that they hated the dreams. It says they specifically hated him and they hated his dreams. Why would they hate his dreams? Because they knew that this was God's revelation of his will. They hated God's decrees. They hated what God had in store for them. Which brings us all the way full circle back to Romans chapter 1. They were haters of God. Why do they need to kill Joseph? As we've said, they intend to disrupt the pattern of the dreams. They intend to stop the plan. Go with me, if you will, to verse 20. We will jump back. But verse 20, it says specifically from the brothers, and we don't know who said this, "Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him." And listen to this. "And we will see what will become of his dreams." The goal was not to shed blood for their brother. In fact, they ultimately found a way not to shed blood. Their goal was to stop the revelation of God's will. Their goal was to stop God's plan in its tracks so that they would not serve their brother. They thought by stopping him, they could stop his dreams. And by stopping his dreams, they could stop the plans of God. They desired, as the serpent did, to alter the will of God. Turn with, if you will, to me, to John chapter 15. And let's look again deeper at where this hatred comes from. Remember, we've described the character of these brothers, how they were raised at a time in Jacob's family that helps us to understand their sinful state. But look at John chapter 15, and let's go to verse 18 and 19. And let's understand, again, this is a context where Christ is sharing with his disciples the response of the people around them as he comes to town. And it says specifically the words of Christ, "If the world hates you, know that it has hated you before it hated me before it hated you." Verse 19, "If you were of the world would love you as its own, but because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you." This is a perfect example of what we're seeing. Jacob's sons were of the world. And they hated Joseph because they see Joseph as an agent on behalf of the Lord. They see God working in his life. They see God revealing his will to him. And they see God using him to bring forth his will. And so it's a natural assumption that his brothers, who are of the world, would hate him for that. "Those who hate you because you've been affected by God's grace will do so because they do not abide in Christ with you." We can see that played out in our lives every day. There are those who will have special hatred for us simply because we've been given God's grace. We've been plucked out from his wrath. And there are those who will look at you in that position alone and have hatred for you because of it. It's not something that we can share easily because we too could have been described by Romans 1 at one time. Partially, we still are. But we've been chosen out of that past state to live in God's grace. And as a result of that grace, we see the hatred of men rising up against us. And it's something that reminds us of the ill will that Joseph's brothers would have had from him. So let's look now at where this hatred specifically comes from. Go if you will. Last week when we finished Genesis 37, we stopped in verse 11. But verse 11 is the key to everything here today. Go back to Genesis 37 with me and let's look at verse 11. And let's try to understand why his brothers hated him so even further. This is right after the dreams were shared and his father rebuked him. And it says, and his brothers were jealous of him. And his brothers were jealous of him. So the cause of their hatred, the source of their dissent, is in their jealousy of Joseph. And friends, this is where the rubber meets the road, because now we get ourselves back to the 10th commandment. Now keep in mind, the commandments had not been shared yet with God's people, but it was known to be that of evil when we understand the 10th commandment, which says, do not covet. Thou shalt not covet your neighbor's wife, your neighbor's house, your neighbor's ox. You shall not covet, which means, in modern day language, you shall not be jealous. It applied just as easily in Joseph's day as it does today. Do not be jealous. Do not let the bitterness of envy cause you to strife. This goes back to the story of Cain rising up and killing his brother Abel. What caused Cain to have such hatred for his brother? It was jealousy of his brother's position that God had bestowed on him. It was Cain rising up and seeing that Abel had been blessed. He had been put in a special place of prominence. He had been gifted by God. And the envy that Cain felt at that moment was more than he could bear. And he took his brother's life. Go to Hebrews 12:15. Well, let me just say it instead of flipping there. Hebrews 12:15, see to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled. No root of bitterness springs up. And you know, the graphical representation of that's pretty good, isn't it? This root of bitterness that would just spring up. The root of bitterness that sprung up in the life of Joseph's brothers. I'll tell you a better analogy from a graphical stance. If we're talking about the root of bitterness and envy and jealousy, would have to be a snowball. As it starts at the top of a hill and works its way down, gathering speed and gathering snow and becoming bigger and bigger. And as this root of bitterness that starts out as some form of covetousness or jealousy or envy comes downhill, that snowball gains strength, it gains power, it gains speed until it becomes disastrous. I have no doubt in my mind, I doubt Joseph's brothers sat there when he shared his dreams and said, we're going to kill him. I don't think that was the case. I think it started off as simple envy or bitterness. But as it built up and they saw his place of prominence and as he enjoyed the fruits of his authority, I think it built up in their lives to the point that they got to the idea that when they saw him from afar, he didn't have to say anything. He may not have even seen them, but when they saw him from afar, they very easily looked at him and said, let's kill him. Because it had built up in their lives so much over the years that they were at the point that the envy had truly eaten them up. Proverbs 14:30 says, a tranquil heart gives life to the flesh, but envy makes the bones rot. Envy's like that. Starts out small and gets bigger and bigger. It generally leads to more harmful thoughts as we go along. And as we look at the fruit of the bitterness from these brothers, as we see what did that bring about, the fruit of their bitterness, they became tempted to take the life of their brother or, as we will see, to seek personal gain in their own way. Paul talked about this when he was talking to the Philippian church. If you recall, Paul wrote his letter to the Philippians from prison, from jail. And as he wrote this letter in Philippians 1, verse 15, let's go there and we can see specifically how Paul shared this. Philippians chapter 1. Some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. Verse 16, the latter do it out of love, knowing that I am put here, meaning prison, for the defense of the gospel. The former, those who preach out of envy and rivalry, the former proclaim Christ out of rivalry, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. The envy even leads those who follow Christ to speak ill of a brother, as they were doing of Paul. And we don't know the purpose that God had necessarily for that, but we know Paul from prison wrote some of his best work for us to share in God's Word. We know that that was a purpose that God had ordained. God had put Paul in prison by his own providence so that he might work through Paul, just as he used Joseph in this case at the hand of his brothers so that he might fulfill his will. We're commanded through the 10th commandment and others not to let the root of bitterness take seed in us. The danger that goes along with envy, the root of bitterness, the hatred that comes from that is dangerous. And yet, it's among us every day. Even today, especially today perhaps, as you think about those who oppose us politically in this country, those who might take a different stance on the family, or those who talk about the liberal rights of an individual or a woman that we disagree with. And we can think of things that cause bitterness and even hatred. And yet we're commanded to pray for these people. There's those who certainly have it better off than we do. And those who have taken advantage of the system and somehow gotten away with it, that we might look to as saying that that's not fair, or that there is a bitter root of envy in me because of that. If anything that we take from the life of Joseph, it's this. It's to see that God can use even the hatred and sinfulness of other men to fulfill his purpose. In fact, he often does quite intentionally, so that we might better see the position that he has for us in the end. You have to look at this and understand that God can use all kinds of circumstances, even that of Joseph being thrown into a waterless pit, that he might bring about his glory. How do we fulfill this command not to be envious, not to covet? Go, if you will, to Philippians 2. You may still be there. Philippians 2, starting with the third verse. If you want to live a life that avoids envy or bitterness, Philippians 2, verse 3, do nothing from rivalry or conceit, but in humility. Count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the form of a servant. Being born in the likeness of men and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Might Joseph have had that in mind? When we start to understand the danger of envy, envy, as we've said, leads to hatred. Hatred to the thought of overt acts and evil acts, even against your kin, in this case. We alternatively are told to live in the Spirit. And the fruit that the Spirit produces in our life will give us the self-control needed to avoid this envy. And even when it doesn't, it will convict us of that sin so that we might come to repentance. The Spirit alone ought to cause a response in our system to this sin. It's what makes it easier for us to read this story today and see that that's evil and hatred. And we can live our lives in a different way. If that's what convicts us of our sin, what was the conviction of the brothers? The brothers who had sinned against their own brother, plotting to kill him, threw him into the pit only because Reuben temporarily sustained his life. What was their response to that? And this is the part that I almost just can't even grasp. Go back to our story in Genesis 37. And in the text it says, verse 24, and they took him and they threw him into a pit. The pit was empty and there was no water in it. So Joseph, stripped of his robe, likely physically harmed, thrown into this pit. It doesn't say specifically what his brothers were saying or yelling or doing as they threw him into this pit. They throw him into this pit, and what's the very next thing we read? Verse 25. Then they sat down to eat. It's hard to imagine. There's no remorse for their sin. There's no anguish. There's no sadness. But there is. And this is where Scripture is so beautiful. You won't know about their anguish. You won't know about the guilt until you get a little bit further down the line, about 22 years down the line to be specific. But there was great anguish. In fact, the spirit that was living and working in Joseph here is there to convict us of our sin. But Romans taught us that all men have built within them a knowledge of God. Whether they want to acknowledge it or not, there's a knowledge of God in them so that when they do these evil things, they do feel remorse. They do suffer anguish for their sin. They feel bad for what they've done. If you want to see the anguish of the brothers, you've got to flip forward. And I told you we'd be doing this in Genesis. Let's flip forward to Genesis chapter 42. And as we fast forward in time, we have to understand what the brothers were feeling as they did this. Now, a point to make here before we do this, what did Joseph feel? It doesn't say that either. It doesn't give us any sense of Joseph's response to being thrown into the pit. We have no idea if he's yelling, screaming, crying, fighting back. We don't know that. But when we go to Genesis chapter 42, we start to see that what might appear as indifference to their sin or absolutely no remorse may be exactly the other. And this is important for us to understand. When we come down to seeing the effects of sin, when we start to understand better the ways that we may have caused others to suffer in the past, it starts to bring to mind some of what you've been through. Or maybe even worse, that you've suffered through this. That you've suffered through something that someone else has put upon you. And to understand the conviction that we get because of what we've done, Genesis 42 does that for us. If we're living according to what we just read in Philippians 2, then you have to reconsider what the brothers felt. It was not indifference. It was not, you know, lack of remorse. They didn't sit down to eat and say, okay, so how about the weather? Genesis 42, starting in verse 18, says specifically, on the third day. Now, let me set the stage real quickly here. The Joseph has been sold. He's risen to a place of prominence in Egypt. The famine has begun. The brothers are told by Jacob to go down to Egypt because I heard they had grain and buy some grain for us. So the brothers go down to Egypt to buy grain and they come before Joseph not knowing that it's Joseph. It says specifically Joseph recognized them, but they did not recognize him. And so the brothers come before him and say, you're worthy and we bow before you, fulfilling the dream. And they go to Joseph to say, we need to buy grain. And Joseph says, no, you're spies. And they said, no, Lord, we're not spies. We're here to buy grain. We're the sons of one father. And Joseph learns his father's still alive and his younger brother. And Joseph says, no, you're spies and I'm going to throw you in jail. So they go into jail for 3 days. Verse 18. On the third day, don't miss that either, Joseph said to them, do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers remain confined where you are in custody, and let the rest go and carry grain for the famine of your households, and bring your youngest brother to me. So your words will be verified, and you shall not die. And they did so. Then they said to one another, and here it is, in truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us, and we did not listen. This is when they threw him into the pit. They grab him, they rip the coat off, they're throwing him into this pit. He's crying, he's anguished, he's begging them not to do so, and they throw him into the pit. 22 years later, they're still feeling the remorse for their sin. The anguish that they've lived with for 22 years for what they did is still with them. Their very first response when they see what Joseph's doing to them is they know they're being punished for their sin. They see it. The conviction is there whether or not they lived with God, whether or not they understood the things of God. They felt it. And so do we. And so do our enemies. It's there. Romans 1, 2, and 3 described it. But it's there. The response that the brothers had to their sin is one that we look at and say that it's unfathomable. It is unfathomable. It didn't happen. They felt great remorse as they threw him down into the pit. And as we read this context, it basically says the brothers, after this time, knew what they had done. They knew that it was evil. And it relates back, and I don't know where I've gotten this from. There was a quote that I've had for many years that says sometimes, and I've misquoted it here, I'm sure, but sometimes sin carries with it the seed of its own punishment. Sometimes the very sin itself is the seed of the punishment that you will bear. In other words, bearing with that sin for 22 years might have been all the punishment they needed. So their response to what God was doing brought great shame to them. And it would bring great shame to them even as they returned home to their father, even though they didn't necessarily respond that way. Now, at this point, you have to say, you know, these men are perfectly described by Romans 1. Not just haters of God, but lovers of evil. The dissension, the hatred, just the outright evil that they display. And so their plot to kill Joseph, where they take him and they throw him into the pit and they hear his screams and his cries and they ignore them as they sit down to eat. And you go, man, how could they be any worse than this? Well, it gets better. And what I mean by that is it does get worse. The brothers who look at this and say, you know, what does this gain us? If you go back to Genesis 37 with me, you'll see, and this is the part that again just seems so hard to believe, but of all the brothers to sit there and hear him screaming in the pit while he's eating his fried chicken, is going to listen to this and he's going to say specifically, wait a minute, I got an idea. Instead of us taking his blood, which really does nothing for us, what do we profit if we kill him? What do we gain if we kill him? In other words, well, yeah, he's down in the pit now, but what's in it for me? And let alone the brother who speaks out is Judah. The lion speaks out and he says specifically in verse 26, then Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? What do I get for it? Yeah, we get rid of the dreamer, but there's no profit to me. Judah came up with a way to make money. Instead of killing him, let's sell him. Make him a slave. We'll get rid of him. We'll pocket a little money on the side here. And then I love the hypocrisy of verse 27. The hypocrisy of verse 27 says, come, let us sell him, our brother, to the Ishmaelites. And let our hand not be upon him. He is our brother, our own flesh. We were going to kill him 5 minutes ago. But now he's our brother. He's our own flesh. He's our family. Let's just sell him. Just the absolute insanity of that statement that Judah shares. We'll sell him. You know, the scripture, as I said, doesn't reveal to us what was said at that moment either. It doesn't show that Joseph is fighting this again or that he's acting out and thrashing in chains. It certainly doesn't say what his brothers are saying about him to the Midianites. And I know the text is confusing. It says, here come the Ishmaelites and then the Midianites. The Midianites are a band of Ishmaelites. It's one and the same. So the band of Ishmaelites who are Midianites coming among them get to them and they sell Joseph as a slave. And it doesn't tell us specifically what was said or done in that context. We don't know anything more about the exchange except that they sold him. They sold him and took the silver. And so as we look at that, we're left with a little bit of wonder about, well, how did that context go down? What was the actual theme that went down? And again, what I would do here is go back to the foreshadowing that we've seen so consistently in Genesis so far. Let's jump forward to Matthew 27. Turn to Matthew chapter 27. And let me read a text that might be something of what happened with Joseph. Verse 27, then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters. And they gathered the whole battalion before him and they stripped him. Sound familiar? They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and put a reed in his right hand. And kneeling before him, they mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they spit on him and took the reed and struck him on the head. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the robe and put his own clothes on him and led him away to crucify him. In Luke, it even says that as they hit him with the reed on the head, they made fun of him by saying, "Now prophesy, tell us who hit you," when he was blindfolded. Verse 32, as they went out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. They compelled this man to carry his cross. And when they came to a place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull, they offered him wine to drink mixed with gall. But when he tasted it, he would not drink it. And when they had crucified him, they divided his garments among them by casting lots. Then they sat down and kept watch over him there, and over his head they put the charge against him, which read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Then two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "You, who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes and elders mocked him, saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now if he desires him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God,' and the robbers who were crucified with him also reviled him in the same way." They mocked him. They made fun of him. Their hatred was carried out again and again. The evil that was displayed at the cross is an even better picture of Romans 1. The ultimate depravity of man. How we can act in such a way. We go back and we look at this account of Joseph and we wonder, was there any chance for escape? Was there any potential salvation? And verse 29, we know Reuben is the one who's trying to salvage Joseph's life. We don't know why. We know that Reuben lost the birthright and that it was given to Joseph, so there should have been some enmity between Reuben and Joseph there. But for some reason, Joseph comes back in a different state of mind than the brothers. Perhaps he was convicted, we don't know. But he had hoped for a chance to rescue Joseph. He perhaps selfishly thought, "Well, maybe if I can save the boy and return him to his father, that the father will restore me to my position, or at least restore me to some of my possessions." And we don't know. The compassion that he may have had for Joseph might have been legitimate. But I think Reuben also believed that it was God's will being revealed through Joseph's life. And ultimately, the saving of the boy was Reuben's intent, but it was not God's will. And we saw Reuben's pain. You know, Reuben acted in such a way here that we start to look at this and we say, well, you know, he maybe had really good intentions. And so again, if you go back where we were, if you still have it, Matthew chapter 26 this time, Matthew 26, starting in verse 30, says, "And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives, and then Jesus said to them," his disciples here, "You will all fall away because of me this night. For it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee.'" And then Peter, brave Peter, answered, "Though they all fall away because of you, I will never fall away." Jesus said to him, "Truly I tell you, this very night before the rooster crows, you will deny me 3 times. Peter said to him, "Even if I must die with you, I will not deny you." And all the disciples said the same. Jump forward to verse 69. "Now Peter was sitting outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came up to him and said, 'You also were with Jesus, the Galilean.' But he denied it before them all, saying, 'I do not know what you mean.' And when he went out to the entrance, another servant girl saw him, and she said to the bystanders, 'This man was with Jesus of Nazareth.' And again he denied it with an oath, 'I do not know the man.' After a little while, the bystanders came up and said to Peter, 'Certainly you too are one of them, for your accent betrays you.' Then he began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, 'I do not know the man.' And immediately the rooster crowed. And Peter remembered the saying of Jesus, 'Before the rooster crows, you will deny me 3 times. And he went out and wept bitterly." We see some of that in Reuben. It was Reuben's attempt to save, but it was not God's will. And it would not happen. As we understand better God's will, His divine revelation of His will, we see that these circumstances could not have been avoided. So we don't know Reuben's intent. Did anyone else grieve over the loss of Joseph? Certainly Jacob did, his father. It says specifically in verse 34 and 35 that Jacob felt the pain of loss. It goes through and it says that Jacob would feel this pain and this mourning. And he said even to the intent of his brothers and sisters, of Joseph's brothers and sisters trying to console him, that he said, no, I will never be consoled. I will go down to Sheol mourning for my son. He said he couldn't take it. And it would have continued to affect Jacob for nearly 30 years before he would learn that his son was still alive. Jacob had great concern for his son because of the love he had for him, as the father would have for a son. But the greatest concern for Joseph's life belonged to God. Joseph must have suffered some anxiety, there's no question. And we know about that from Genesis 42. When we see specifically that he cried out for help or he begged for his life, we know that he suffered some anxiety. But it's as if Joseph knew the story of Peter ahead of time. It's as if Joseph knew that what Peter was going to suffer and how he would fail miserably would be used to better build Peter. 1 Peter 5:7 says, cast all your anxiety on him because he cares for you. That's what Joseph did. He cast all of his anxiety on the Lord. This was the source of Joseph's faith. And this was the character that we talked about last week of Joseph, likely passed down from his father, or better yet, from his grandfather. Remember, Joseph's grandfather died in Genesis 35. And so when we read about that, it's very likely that Joseph sat at the feet of his grandfather Isaac as Isaac shared with him the story of true faith. And he shared with him and he said, true faith, my boy, is when you see what my father did to me. When he was commanded by the Lord to take me to the mountain and sacrifice me, he did so obediently because he knew that no matter what God had in store, no matter what circumstances he was forced to suffer under, that he would provide what he needed. It's Isaac sitting there relating to his grandson the story of how Abraham was about to kill Isaac and had the knife above him when the angel stepped in and said, stop! I know now your faith. And Joseph learned of this great faith that he could have in this Lord under any circumstance, even under the apparent circumstances of being killed by his brothers, where Joseph would have to look at that with faith and say, if this is meant to happen to me to reveal God's will, so be it to happen. But it was God's will. Joseph maintained his faith through the most dire of circumstances. It was by God's providence that Joseph was not killed by his brothers, that he was sold to Midianite slave traders. In fact, it's by providence that he was taken by those same slave traders to Egypt, where God would provide for his people. It was by God's providence that he was given and sold to Potiphar, the captain of the guard for Pharaoh. And it was by providence in Potiphar's household that he would be sold, or that he would be accused and be put into prison. And it was by God's providence that he'd be put into prison with Pharaoh's baker and cupbearer. And it was by God's providence that he would interpret the dreams of both men so that 2 years later he would be remembered by the cupbearer so that he could interpret the dreams of Pharaoh. This was not a long weekend for Joseph. These were years in his life where he suffered, and yet he maintained faith. Joseph would indeed rise to a position of prominence in Egypt. God's will would have him in a place where he could be used to provide for God's people. He didn't have to be in the messianic line to save God's people in this case. But we see this story unfold so that we might better understand our own circumstances. We might better understand our own sufferings, as little as they may be in the grand scheme of things. That they're all used according to God's purpose. They're used to fulfill His will, so that He might preserve His people. He did use Joseph to preserve the messianic line. Why, perhaps, would we think God would want to preserve the people that are described in Romans chapter 1. The insolent haters of God. Because we know from the very beginning he promised a seed that would be used to transform these people. That he, out of his own love, would reach down and bring them back to him. And that as part of his greater plan and his will to be done, that he would send the promised one at the appropriate time. Not beforehand. But he would send the appropriate one, and his rich providence has fulfilled his will since that time. And we know that what God has purposed for good may sometimes be shown in the evil of man. But we're encouraged in Romans 5 to persevere, because that perseverance or endurance produces character. That character produces hope. And it's that hope that we have in God's fulfilling his will to bring us back to him. It's the great story. God will preserve and provide in his own time. He's not indifferent, and he is not ineffective. He's in control. And we may suffer from time to time, but the point and the purpose is that we might see his glory played out above all else. And that's where we find hope. It's in the hope of his future glory that we might partake with him. Let's pray.
You've been listening to the podcast of Grace Family Baptist Church, Conroe. For any questions or comments regarding Grace Family Baptist Church, call 281-661-3623 or go online to gfbcconroe.com.